Welcome to Spirit Stories 2022. My name is Brad Paquette. I'm the director of the School of Kingdom Writers. I have three amazing storytellers lined up for you tonight. These storytellers have been practicing and perfecting these stories, and we are so excited to share them with you. Now, Halloween is an interesting time in America for a Christian. On one hand, there's a lot of elements, a lot of factors that we don't want to have anything to do with, right? Because the black arts, you know, the dark side of the supernatural is active on Halloween. These are the high holidays of Satanists. And that's a very real reality that we have to confront. But sometimes that leads us to go inside and lock the doors. And we're missing such a tremendous opportunity when we do that. On this one night of the year, it's a really normal thing to interact with all of your neighbors, to interact with your whole community. I mean, when else can you go door to door with your kids and knock on the door and say hello to every single one of your neighbors? When else is it normal to have conversations about the supernatural? When else are your neighbors confronting their own mortality and asking hard questions about what happens after death? And so these are tremendous opportunities for the church to stand up, to be a part of our community, but do so in such a way that represents the light and life of Jesus Christ. So that's what we're here to do tonight. So we have three true stories. Now, many of these stories are quite old, and the firsthand accounts are not always available. So these storytellers have taken the liberty to dress up the stories, to fill in the gaps, and sort of round them out so you can have a nice experience. But the critical elements of every single story is absolutely true. So tonight, we have three storytellers. The first will be Allison Prince, the second will be Tirza Grafune, and the third will be Lindsay Bakken. I want you to stay for all three of them because I think you're going to find that there are three very different stories that each of these storytellers has chosen. So with no further ado, I want to introduce Allison Prince from Las Vegas, Nevada. She's here as a first-year apprentice at the School of Kingdom Writers, and she's delighted to share the story of St. Lucian and St. Marcion.
Come with me, all the way back to the year 250 AD, as I tell you the story of St. Lucian and St. Marcion. These two friends lived in an ancient Greek city called Nicomedia, which would have been located where Turkey is. Now, I've never been to Turkey personally, but I have heard that it is breathtakingly beautiful. From the lovely beaches to the vast mountains to the sprawling city, I can just picture myself strolling along the streets, the sun warm on my back, and the sweet smell of baklava to guide me. Lucian and Marcion weren't always well-known saints. In fact, they had their own less than ideal reputation around the city of Nicomedia. You see, Lucian and Marcion did perform miracles of sorts, but don't be fooled. They did not do these acts in the name of the Lord. Lucian and Marcion were extremely talented performers of the black arts. They studied dark magic and spent their time and talents on potions and spells that could charm even the prudest of individuals to do their bidding, and often found joy in charming young, beautiful maidens to fall madly in love with them. It's here, in the city of Nicomedia, that the two friends strolled together. Shops and merchants sat on either side. Marcion walked, his nose stuck in a book, as Lucian led the way. They wove through the small crowd. The sound of shopkeepers and customers haggling for prices rose around them. The gravel and sand crunched beneath their sandal-clad feet. Suddenly, Lucian stopped. Marcion bumped into his back with a soft grunt. He looked up with a glare, a complaint ready on his tongue, when he saw exactly who Lucian had stopped for. There, standing just ahead of them, a young woman with beautiful tan skin and perfectly sculpted lips stood. Lucian looked at Marcion and wiggled his brows. Marcion, in turn, gave a half-hearted sigh and snapped his book shut. Together, the two made their way through the crowd and towards the young maiden. Lucian saddled up alongside her. He dropped a golden purple talisman from his hand and held it by its golden chain. He dangled it back and forth across her eyes. Marcion stood on her other side, reading out a chant from his book. The maiden stood, her eyes wide, as she glanced between the two. Then, with a grimace sort of smile and a polite nod, she turned and walked directly away. The two friends stood in silence, the talisman still dangling from Lucian's hand. as they watched her disappear into the crowd. "It didn't work," Lucien said, eyes narrowed as he turned to Marcian. "Why didn't it work?" "How should I know?" Marcian said. Lucien huffed and shoved the talisman back in his pouch. Quickly, they rushed after the maiden. "Excuse me," Lucien called out as they caught sight of her. Ahead of them, the maiden turned, spotted them, and put on a burst of speed. "No, thank you. I don't want to buy anything," she called back as they rushed past the market and wove their way through the crowd. She veered to the left and disappeared between two shops. Lucien and Marcian pursued. They broke into the alleyway and finally caught the young maiden. Lucian's hand snatched her wrist. The maiden stuck her feet firm as she yanked against his grip. "No one can resist our spells. So tell us, maiden, by what authority do you deny us?" Lucien asked. The maiden stood tall, her eyes defiant, her shoulders straight as she said, "By the authority that Jesus Christ has given me." Lucien and Marcian shared a confused glance before Marcian, a hint of hesitation in his voice, asked, "Who is Jesus Christ?" Lucien and Marcian listened intently as she told them how she had been a sinner. Then, because the one true God loved her, he sent his only son to die as a sacrifice for her. 3 days later, he rose from the dead and gave her his Holy Spirit, which empowered her to speak with the authority in his name. "The good news," the maiden spoke, "is that this authority is available to everyone, even you. All you have to do is accept the gift." The two friends were amazed by these things. A man who had died and come back to life? Never in all their history of dark magic had they seen or heard of someone who had authority over life and death. The three spent many hours together, huddled in the alley, as they discussed the power of Christ. She urged them to turn from their black arts and devote themselves to Christ instead. The two friends wasted no time. Together, they gathered up all of their potions, their talismans, their amulets, their dark magic books, and they went into the square. They piled up all of these artifacts and tools and then burned them. Then, as the flames rose, they declared themselves Christians and turned from their ways. They set out, gave their wealth to the poor, and began to travel around Nicomedia and the surrounding cities to share what they had learned. Together, the two friends performed many miraculous signs, such as healing the sick and giving out blessings rather than curses. Not all good things last, however. Many years into their ministry, the Roman Empire had begun to make its mark upon the lands. During the reign of Decius, the Roman Emperor gave way to a new order. Everyone must perform a sacrifice to the Roman gods and worship them. Lucien and Marcian refused and were some of the first among many Christians to be arrested for denying the authority of the Romans. With chains around their wrists, they were brought into a large marble chamber. Observers and council members stood along the edge of the room in between large white pillars. The clattering of their metal echoed off the walls. Lucien and Marcian shared a look as they stopped in the middle of the room and stood before the proconsul of the region, a man by the name of Sabinus. He stood above Marcian and Lucien, his lower half hidden by a marble podium. The two friends listened intently as their crimes for refusing the Roman Empire were read aloud. Sabinus stood and ran a hand over his lips and looked down at the two friends. "And by what authority do you refuse the Roman Emperor Decius?" Sabinus asked. Lucien squared his shoulders, a defiant look in his eyes. "By the authority that Jesus Christ has given us." His voice echoed through the marble chamber. Sabinus's eyes darkened. "Then listen to my authority. I hereby sentence you to be tortured by the rack and executed," Sabinus replied, with a casual wave of the hand. Lucien grimaced as the Roman soldiers grabbed their chains and began to drag them away. Marcian stood firm, his wrists digging into the metal as he resisted. "Tell me this, proconsul," he called. Sabinus stopped, eyebrows raised as Marcian continued. "Why were we not persecuted for our practice of dark magic, and yet we are persecuted for our love of Christ? We controlled hundreds of innocent people by the name and the authority of the dark arts, and the Romans stood by and said nothing. Yet, the moment we begin to preach the gospel and tell of our love of Jesus, we are captured and condemned." Sabinus's nostrils flared as he replied, "You watch your tongue, lest I command further torture upon you." Marcian stood tall. With a steady voice, he said, "We are ready to suffer, but we will never renounce the one true God." Angered at their words, Proconsul Sabinus sentenced them to be burned alive. Together, as they were led to the pyre, the friends sung hymns and praises. The smoke rose up and billowed around their heads and carried the tune of their joyful song through the city of Nicomedia. And together, the two friends expired amongst the flames and joined Christ in heaven. Hundreds of years later, in the 14th century, they were recognized by the Catholic Church as martyrs and assigned sainthood for their bravery and active walk in the authority that Christ gave them.
Thank you so much, Allie, for sharing that wonderful story with us. Next up, I want to present Tirza Grafune. Tirza is a second-year apprentice here at the School of Kingdom Writers, so you may recognize her from Spirit Stories 2021. Tonight, she's going to share with us the incredibly inspiring and faith-filled story of George Mueller. So, Tirza Grafune.
Faith does not operate in the realm of the possible. There is no glory for God in that which is humanly possible. Faith begins where man's power ends. That is a quote by a man named George Mueller, a man who had a great amount of faith. George Mueller grew up in Prussia, which is now Germany, way back in the 1800s. George's father was a wealthy tax collector, and he wanted George to become a clergyman, so he sent George to seminary at the University of Halle. Back then, it was quite common for sons who came from families with wealth or influence to be made clergymen and placed in churches with well-to-do churchgoers. These churchgoers would not only pay a lot of tithes, but they would also pay a large sum of money just so that they could sit in the fancy cushioned pews in the front row, the seats of honor. That money would go straight to the clergyman. So if George got a position at a church like that, he'd be set for life. Becoming a clergyman had nothing to do with faith and everything to do with money and connections. So despite the fact that George was studying to be a clergyman, he certainly didn't act like a man of God. He wasn't interested in listening to God or helping others. George liked to party. He went to bars and played cards. He enjoyed mocking and making fun of people just because he could. He loved money and lied, stole, cheated, gambled to get or keep it. He'd get drunk whenever he wasn't in class and even went to jail on one occasion. But one Saturday afternoon, George went on a walk with his good friend Beta. As they walked down a stone path with pine trees on either side, Beta cleared his throat. "I think I'd best be getting back." George laughed. "Why, have you something better to do? Perhaps a date for this evening?" he teased. Beta shook his head. "Actually, I'll be attending a Bible study tonight," he said. George blinked in surprise. "A Bible study? What do you do there? Simply read the Bible?" Beta shrugged, eyes trained on the ground. "Yes, well, we also sing and pray and read a printed sermon." George stopped walking, staring at his friend. For some odd reason, he felt in his soul that he had to go with Beta to that Bible study. "May I come?" he asked. Beta's gaze shot up to George's, and his eyes widened. "You?" he laughed. "George, it's no night at the tavern. I don't think you'd enjoy yourself very much." George pursed his lips, shaking his head. "Perhaps not, but I want to come." Seeing his friend's determination, Beta stopped laughing. "Well, if you're truly so set on it, then I suppose you can come. But don't blame me if you find it boring." The two friends parted ways. And that very evening, George attended the Bible study for the very first time. At that Bible study, George met Christians who loved God and wanted to honor him in all they said and did. Their faith shone like a bright light, which shocked and stunned George. Shortly after attending the Bible study, George decided to give his life over to the Lord. Immediately, George was a completely different person. No more stealing, lying, cheating, gambling, or getting drunk. His friends didn't even recognize him anymore, and a lot of them stopped hanging out with him. In fact, George had changed so much that he even made the decision to become a missionary. When George's father heard that his son had plans to actually serve God, he was furious. He had put George in seminary to become a rich, stuffy clergyman, not a poor, starving missionary. So he told George to give up on his foolish ideas of becoming a missionary, or else he'd stop paying for George's education. Well, George had made his decision, and he wouldn't be swayed, so his father cut him off completely. George was in a small apartment pacing back and forth. With no help from his father and no job, how is he supposed to pay for his room and board, let alone his schooling? He stopped pacing and got down on his knees. He prayed, asking God to provide for him. An hour later, a professor knocked on the door, offering George a well-paying tutoring job. From that moment on, George was convinced that God would always provide for him and his needs. After university, George traveled to Bristol, England, where he started a ministry caring for orphans. But here's the amazing part. From the very beginning, George never asked anyone for donations or for any help taking care of the orphans. He believed that if the Lord wanted the children to be fed, clothed, and educated, then the Lord would provide the resources necessary to make that happen. And God did provide, time and time again. One day in the late 1830s, the sun had barely risen in Bristol, England, but George was already up in his study, reading his Bible and praying for the day ahead. As he flipped the page, a knock sounded on the wooden doorframe. He looked up. Anna, the house mother of the orphanage, stood just outside the doorframe. She wore a worried look on her face, lips pursed and hands clasped tightly behind her back. "Mr. Mueller," she said, "the children are dressed and ready for school, but there is no food for them to eat." George set his Bible down on the desk, scooting his wooden desk chair back as he stood. "Is that so?" Anna nodded. "The tables are set, I made sure of it myself, but there is no food or drink to fill them with. There's not even a crumb left in the larder. Is there any money, at least for bread?" George Mueller smiled. "Anna, please bring the children into the dining room and have them sit at the tables." Anna's shoulders slumped in relief. If Mr. Mueller wasn't concerned, then he must have the money for bread. The children would be fed and all would be well. She nodded and left the room to go gather the children. As Anna left, George pressed his lips together and hummed. There wasn't a single farthing left, and even if there was, it wouldn't be nearly enough to feed all 300 children that were currently staying at the orphanage. The children filed into the large dining room. They sat at the round wooden tables as instructed, examining what had been set before them. As usual, there were cups, plates, bowls, spoons, knives, and forks, but this time, there was no breakfast. Sam, one of the young orphan boys, turned to look at his neighbor. "Where's the food?" he asked in a not-so-hushed whisper. His neighbor, a boy named Peter, shrugged. "Dunno," he said. "Haps there isn't any." Sam's eyes widened. "No food? If there's no food, do you think we'll be missing our schooling too?" As the two boys spoke, George Mueller entered the room. "Children," he said, "you know we must be in time for school." He lifted his hands toward the dining room's high ceiling. "Dear Father, we thank thee for what thou art going to give us to eat." The words had scarcely left his mouth when a knock came at the front door. George left the dining room and walked into the front hall, opening the door. Charlie, the baker man, stood there. "Mr. Mueller," Charlie said, "I couldn't sleep last night. Somehow I felt the children didn't have any bread for breakfast, and the Lord wanted me to send some. So I got up and baked some fresh bread and I brought it." George glanced behind Charlie at the street. Charlie's wagon was parked on the red cobblestone in front of the orphanage, and in the wagon, George spotted several large baskets full of bread. With some help, Charlie and George took all the bread inside to the dining room. George smiled. "Children, we not only have bread, but the rare treat of fresh bread," he announced. As they finished distributing the bread, there was another knock at the front door. Once again, George left the dining room and walked into the front hall to answer the door. This time, it was the milkman, with his hat in hand. "Sorry to bother you like this, but my cart's broke down and the milk will spoil by the time it's fixed. I don't suppose you'd want some milk for the children's breakfast, would you?" The milkman brought in 10 large cans of milk, just enough for Sam, Peter, and the rest of the 300 thirsty children. What a miracle! But that isn't the only time that miraculous things have happened to George. In fact, George Mueller is said to have had over 50,000 specific prayers answered during his lifetime, and he'd record each one of them in a notebook so he could remember everything that God had done for him. The Lord provided for George Mueller, but he'll also provide for us and our needs. Whether we're feeding hundreds of orphans, trying to make ends meet, or just looking for a reason to smile, We can take God at his word and place our faith in him to provide. Philippians 4:19, "And my God will supply every need of yours according to his riches and glory in Christ Jesus."
Thank you so much for sharing that story, Tirza. George Mueller is such an inspiring character, and you should look him up. There are so many more stories like that one that will change your faith. Lastly tonight, I want to introduce Lindsay Backen. Lindsay joins us as a first-year apprentice from Texas, so she's come a long way to share this story tonight. And she's going to share the story of Todd Beasley. This is a more modern story, but it's such a powerful example of the power of Jesus Christ over the satanic arts that are often featured on holidays like this one. So get ready to be inspired. Get ready to put your faith fully in the Lord as you hear this story told. So, Lindsay Backen.
People often celebrate Halloween by decorating their homes with ghosts, spider webs, and bones. But back in 1959, bones were something that Todd thought of every single day. Todd had brittle bone disease, a condition where defective genes affect the body's ability to make the collagen protein that helps strengthen bones. Sometimes brittle bone disease will cause only a few fractures for a person. Other times it can result in hundreds of fractures with no apparent cause. Todd could not have a normal childhood playing like other children. He couldn't run or roll down a hill with his friends. Bumps caused far more destruction than simple bruises, and something like riding a bike was simply out of the question. Eventually, he stopped going to school. He became very lonely, and his entire life was controlled by a painful condition that had no cure. Then, in 1959, Todd broke his bones again. He ended up in the hospital with a broken leg. The hospital was dreary. White walls, dozens of white beds lining the room. A small white bed with a curved frame with white bars that created a headboard that made Todd think of a prison. From his bed, he could reach a little light with a white cover that he turned on and off with a chain. There wasn't very much to do. Most of the patients down the row were reading. The boy next to him was about 14 years old. The boy's name was Sam, and he was reading a comic book called Strange Adventures that pictured a giant hand coming down to grab a Corvette that sped so fast its wheels made little clouds of dirt. Todd read the little yellow bubble that proclaimed the title, The Hand from Beyond, and wondered what the story was about. He thought of asking, but then he heard his mother say his name. He glanced toward the door where she was speaking to the doctor in the hallway. Well, how bad is it? He heard his mother say. We can do surgery on the leg tomorrow, but I don't know if we can save it. It may have to come off. Todd was horrified. He sank back against his pillow, looking again at the disembodied hand on the cover. His own body was already deformed from years and years of broken bones. By this time tomorrow, he could wake up to be the kid with a missing leg. And what if next time he lost his other leg? An arm? Both arms? What if he ended up as only a torso with no arms or legs? The worst part about being in the hospital was all the other patients could see you in your bed. Todd bit his lip. Everyone in the room was going to see if he cried, though most were sleeping or reading anyway. He blinked to hold back the tears, but some escaped. Sam looked up from his comic book. What's the matter? Todd's throat was so tight he had to swallow before he tried to talk. His voice still wobbled in an unmanly tone as he said, They're talking about cutting off my leg tomorrow. You can join the circus and be like Worm Man or something, Sam teased. Todd covered his face and cried. Hey, don't cry. I was just kidding, Sam said. My uncle came home from the war without his leg and he does all right. Dad says it's no use to worry over something until it actually happens. But it is actually happening, Todd said. They're going to take my leg off, maybe even tomorrow. Sam tapped his fingers against his comic book like he was trying to map out an escape route. He glanced over at Todd a few times, then nodded to himself. He glanced at the kid sleeping across from them, and then leaned close to whisper, "Everything will be okay with your leg. All you gotta do is join my club." Tom swallowed again, wiping his eyes with his arm. He stared at the boy, who gave a confident nod. What do you mean? What club? The Devil's Club, Sam said. Todd was so shocked, he didn't know what to do, so he laughed. But Sam's eyes grew dark and serious. "I mean it," he said. "But you have to know, once you join, there is no getting out." "He won't let you." By the end of the night, Todd had joined the Devil's Club. Making a vow to serve Satan and to give him his soul in exchange for his leg. The moment he made his vow, pain began to gather, an intense darkness creeping into his mind until it caused physical pain, but it was too late. He had sold his soul to the devil. There was nothing left to do except hope that it worked. After he'd gone through the surgery, he woke to find his leg was still there. 6 weeks later, his leg had healed, straighter and stronger than his opposite leg, which had never been broken. But every day he was racked with an ever-growing sense of guilt and despair, waiting for the moment Satan would come for his soul. He didn't know what to do. He couldn't tell anyone about his vow, even his parents. Now, when he read his Bible, hoping to find some sort of redemption, the only verses he saw said things like, "Woe to you, hypocrite." He continued going to church with his parents, but suddenly God seemed to be a cold-hearted entity. Convinced that God hated him, Todd stopped attending church as soon as he grew up. He put as much distance between himself and God as he could. If God hated him and Satan was taking him to hell as soon as he died, the only thing to do was to have as good a time with the rest of his life as he could. Todd began to party and soon got into drugs. He did everything he could not to think about God. But it was hard. There did seem to be some sort of battle going over his soul, with one entity bent on killing him and another bent and determined to keep him from hell. One day, a tornado traveled toward his car. He was more scared than he had ever been in his life. Surely this was it. This was Satan coming for his soul. But the tornado lifted, passing a mere 10 feet above his hood. Another time, he went through a car accident that led to another accident. And in 3 years, he went through 8 car accidents and walked away without even a scratch or one broken bone. He had run for so long from God that he wasn't sure if it was God or Satan who was saving him. But he started thinking if Satan was waiting for his soul, that maybe God was actually keeping him alive. He began a tentative search for God, but after so long, he wasn't sure where to find him. He did find other things, though. He married a kind-hearted woman and created a thriving career using his voice to work in radio. Part of his job was recording commercials and religious programming for Sunday morning. One day, a pastor came to the station and recorded a sermon. After he was done recording, they were standing in the doorway chatting about life. "Before I go," the pastor asked, "I want to ask you, have you ever given your life to Christ?" Todd's secrets swelled up, the thing he had never told anyone. The thing he couldn't tell anyone. He didn't know what would happen to him if he told, only that it would be terrible. Maybe the healing on his leg would be undone. Maybe Satan would break all of his bones. Maybe he would die. But he had lived with fear and guilt for so long that today he decided to break his silence, despite the promised repercussions. "I can't," he whispered. "I made a vow in exchange for my leg. And I have been plagued with guilt and fear ever since. He's been trying to kill me over and over." The pastor listened while his story of the broken leg and his vow that he'd given Satan poured out. He waited through the rushed whispers, the pauses, and the tearful conclusion. He nodded, then asked, "You know Satan is a liar, right?" Todd was stunned. Satan was a liar? Was there a way out? "You got some coffee around here?" the pastor asked. "Well, sit down and I'll show you in the Bible." "The coffee pot's over there," Todd said. "I'll make a whole pot." So they sat down and the steaming drinks cooled as the pastor opened his Bible and pushed it toward Todd with his finger on the page. "Look here what Jesus said. In John 8:55, you belong to your father, the devil, and you want to carry out your father's desires. He was a murderer from the beginning, not holding to the truth, for there is no truth in him. When he lies, he speaks his native language, for he is a liar and the father of lies." Todd sat stunned, but before he could even fully replay the verse, the preacher asked, "Who's holding you to your vow?" "Satan," Todd said quickly. "Is he?" the preacher asked. "Or is he lying?" Todd took a breath, too scared to be hopeful. He shrugged. "I mean," he said, "even if it is, does God even want me back?" "God always wants you back," the preacher said, "no matter what you've done." He felt a swell of hope in his chest, even though chills were running all over his body. His vow was not irrevocable. Satan couldn't hold him to it, couldn't force him to hell. And God didn't want him to go. God hadn't walked away, hadn't stopped loving or protecting him. It was God who kept him alive all those times when he thought that Satan had come to collect his soul. It wasn't too late. "God," he whispered, "I want you back." He revoked his vow. He asked Jesus to save him. And as he spoke, he felt like this huge weight lifted off his shoulders. He was no longer controlled by fear. Satan had no claim to him. For the first time, he was able to talk about the vow he had made and the freedom he found to break it. He went home and told his wife all about the secret. Then he told his parents everything he had gone through, and his fear dissipated. He no longer dreaded that this may be his last day, or even felt afraid of dying, because now dying was just being united with God, and not a power that would torment him. Years after he became a Christian, he and his wife Sherry welcomed their son into the world, but their joy was quickly dashed when they found out that his son had the same brittle bone disease that he did. They prayed together every single day that God would heal his son. And by the time his son was 10 years old, he had not broken one bone. Todd was elated. He was so thankful for God's healing and that his son would never have to experience the pain and torment that he had. He continued to tell people about his story. It doesn't matter what you've done in your life. It doesn't matter what you feel bound to, what you think controls you, or even if you've made a vow to Satan that you feel like you can't take back. He loves you. God wants to save you. It is not too late. All you have to do is ask.
Thank you so much for sharing that inspiring story, Lindsay. So all of these stories that you've heard tonight are true. This is the power of God in the real world. Reality is that God came to earth as the man Jesus Christ. He lived a sinless life, and he died on the cross. He died a terrible death to pay the price for all the sin of all of mankind, so that you could have a way to be reconnected with God, to spend all of eternity with him. Now, it's up to you to accept that free gift. And all you have to do is say yes to Jesus. The Bible tells us very clearly that if you believe in your heart and you profess with your mouth that Jesus is Lord, that you will be saved. So if you haven't yet done that, tonight is the right time. In this season, as we wrap up this Halloween season, as we confront our own mortality and as we examine what that looks like, now is the time. Don't let another day pass without putting your faith in Jesus Christ for all eternity. So if you're ready to do that, you can pray a very simple prayer. You can simply pray, "Lord, I'm a sinner. I can't fix my sin without you. Would you please come into my heart? Thank you for paying the price for my sin. Thank you for making a place for me in all of eternity. I accept you as my Lord. And if you pray that, if you've prayed that prayer tonight, then you're good. You're done. Your salvation is sure in Jesus Christ. Now, there's some important things that you can do, like you can get connected to other believers in your area. You can begin to read the Bible to learn more about the God who loves you. But your salvation is assured just simply by placing your faith genuinely in the Lord by saying a simple prayer like that one. So, in this season of mortality, in this season of spooks and specters and ghosts and talking about the supernatural, I hope that you won't leave this season without assuring your supernatural destiny for all eternity. So again, thank you for watching. Thank you for supporting our lovely storytellers tonight. We hope to see you again next year with more spooky and interesting stories of the church's heroes.